It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Every day right now, it seems, we get a new piece of news about the promising vaccines for COVID-19. The vaccines bring hope and the possibility of light at the end of this long, dark pandemic tunnel that we're living in. But there are important questions, including these. Will enough people in this country be willing to get vaccinated? How can public health experts effectively make the case for vaccination in the face of skepticism, denial, and fear? Later this hour, anthropologist Emily Wenzel of the University of Iowa will be here to talk about what she has learned from interviewing people who volunteered to participate in a COVID-19 vaccination study. But first, we're going to try to understand the history of vaccination in this country, and more importantly, the history of resistance to vaccination. Bernice Hausman is the author of Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. She's also chair of the Department of Humanities at the Penn State University College of Medicine, and she's with me on the line from Hershey, Pennsylvania. Hello, Bernice.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here. And of course, in the past decade plus, we have heard a lot of rhetoric about so-called anti-vaxxers, people who refuse to get vaccinations and refuse to vaccinate their children. This has been a huge source of controversy. And of course, because this is the internet age, it has also gotten really ugly. So in your book, you try to get past all of the divisive language and the vitriol to really explore this skepticism about vaccines that some people feel is so important. So tell me about your approach, what you wanted to do with this book.
So thank you for having me. I'm super happy to be on Iowa Public Radio. I spent 7 great years at the University of Iowa in graduate school living in Iowa City. So I'm really happy to be on the show.
Oh, that's great. I had no idea.
Yeah. Wonderful. So I really wanted in the book to do exactly what the subtitle says, reframe the controversy. So instead of it being when I started studying vaccine controversy, I created a research group with undergraduate students at Virginia Tech, where I was teaching at the time, and we first called the group the Vaccine Refusal Research Group. And after one semester, it was extremely clear that to understand the controversy, we couldn't point towards a group of people and say, "You're the problem. Vaccine refusers, you're the problem." And we had to actually approach it from a more neutral position and to say there's this social controversy around vaccines. Let's look into why it exists, and especially why it exists in a context where we actually have very, very high rates of vaccination. So that's the context for starting the research, which I did in 2010. The idea really in the book is to say let's look seriously at the concerns that people have, not to necessarily legitimate them, but not to delegitimate them either, not to assess them and say they're right or wrong, but to actually say, what do they mean? What are people worried about? How, if we do this kind of deep dive into written texts and public discourse, what do we find are the themes that emerge and the concerns that people have, and how can we elevate them beyond just the you're right or wrong, science says this, science doesn't say this, but really how these concerns are animated in people's lives.
Well, and in reading your book, I was struck by the fact that people on both sides of this debate maybe don't have a very firm grasp on the history of vaccination in this country and on how people have felt about vaccination through time. I think a lot of us certainly have embraced the polio vaccination story, and maybe that's something that shows up in history classes. But other than that, this is not something people know a whole lot about. So take us back in time a little bit. Let's talk about vaccination in the United States and how it grew in acceptance.
So, yeah, the history is very instructive. So for a very long time, there was one vaccine, the smallpox vaccine, which was developed in the late 18th century by a British physician. And then, and it was actually mandated in England, and there were riots in England. There were riots in the United States in the 19th century against the compulsory vaccination during smallpox outbreaks. There's a famous Supreme Court case in 1905 called Jacobson versus Massachusetts, which is being invoked today as we look at state-level authority to compel public health measures. But in 1905, the Supreme Court ruled that the state could compel people to be vaccinated. So what that says, though, is that they had to go absolutely to the they had to go to the Supreme Court because people were resisting vaccination, even against a disease that was as dangerous and fatal as smallpox. In the late 1800s and the early 19th century, as bacteriology as a scientific practice developed, you started to see the development of vaccines, and you've got like kind of this sort of slow rollout through the 20th century of various vaccines. The diphtheria toxin antitoxin vaccine, pertussis was developed, influenza vaccines were developed in the 1940s. But the big case, as you point out, is polio in the 1950s. That was the first vaccine that was really part of this huge federal effort to develop a vaccine and then roll it out for the entire country. And we know that it was the Salk vaccine was the initial vaccine. That was the injected polio vaccine, which is a version of that is still in use today. And then in the early 1960s, the Sabin vaccine, which is the oral vaccine. Many of us remember those, the oral vaccine on sugar cubes that we were given as children. Even though in the 1950s, even during the we have this image of the polio pioneers, these children who were part of this experiment to see if the polio vaccine worked and was safe. And even then, parents held their children out from those trials because they were uncertain of the outcome.
I just want to dwell on that for just a moment, because, again, I think that that is the moment that a lot of people who are really alarmed by vaccine skeptics point to, that moment in time where there was this just terrible, debilitating virus that was attacking people from out of nowhere, you know, that could change a life in a moment or take a life. And this vaccine came along and it made it possible for people to live without that fear. And that's such a touchstone for so many people. And we'll talk about some of the emotions that get heated again on both sides of this debate. But I think that that is one of those moments that people who really get upset about the idea of anybody not vaccinating their children reach to. And it just sets a fire.
Well, and what's interesting is that immediately after, there's a couple of things about the rollout of the polio vaccine that are important to think about. First of all, there was an incident after the vaccine was approved. So after they ran through the evidence of the trial and they approved the vaccine, there was this push to make a lot of vaccine and then get it in the arms of children. There was an incident, it's called the Cutter Incident, and a physician author, Paul Offit, has a book called The Cutter Incident, where the Cutter Laboratories, they had an industrial problem with the production of the vaccine, and it was given out to hundreds of thousands of people, and 10 children died. There were cases of polio because there was inadequate killing of the virus. So immediately, you have this kind of set of questions around, you know, are these processes safe? And they, you know, shut down the labs and they figured out what the problem was. But, you know, this is a historical kind of reality that we are relying on these industrial processes to create these products that are going to protect us against illness. And, you know, there's always room for error. So that was one lesson, was that it's the sort of the triumph of vaccination, the history has these sort of moments of failure in it that, you know, can be dangerous.
Absolutely.
The other thing that is really important, though, is that right after the polio vaccine comes out, is that, you know, you get a lot of vaccinations and then there's this fall off. And there's a problem that public health sees that parents are not, you know, continuing to get their children in for vaccinations. There's this great need for persuasion. So you don't have, at the level of practice, this kind of like, okay, we now have the vaccine and everybody is on board. You know, you have this kind of back and forth perception of danger, desire for prevention, slacking off, and then a kind of need to be pushed again to get children vaccinated. And so it is not the case that then you can sort of say, well, this, you have this triumph of vaccines, and then ever after, everybody is enthralled with them. There's more of a back and forth.
Well, and we have seen with the an increase or at least a louder push for this vaccine resistance, we saw that concurrently with a lot of breakthroughs in vaccines, with a real increase in the number of vaccines recommended for children, right?
Right. So that's the story of the 1990s. And there's, you know, you have a tremendous increase in the number of vaccines that children get as infants and young children, and you have growing uncertainties among parents about what are the effects of all these new vaccines. And so, you know, I was born in the early 1960s, and I had, you know, kind of 7 or 8 vaccines as a child, right? I think it was 7 at the time. I was part of the group that needed to be revaccinated with measles in order to go to graduate school in the late 1980s, because at that point they added a booster shot because there were breakthroughs in congregate settings. You know, large numbers of people, like high schools, were seeing measles cases because of the fact that you know, measles vaccine is very effective, but there are always a few people who are not going to respond immunologically to the vaccine. When you get enough of those people together, you can have breakthroughs. So in the late 80s, they added the second measles shot. But
and we'll have to talk more about that in just a moment. We are going to take a short break. With me is Bernice Hausman. She is the author of the book Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. Later in the hour, we will also talk about what COVID-19 vaccines may hold for us. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this hour we're talking about vaccinations and the history of skepticism about vaccinations. We'll also take a look ahead. We're not psychic, but we'll take a look ahead to what the COVID-19 vaccines may hold for us and how to convince people possibly to actually receive these vaccines. With me this hour is Bernice Hausman. She is the author of Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. And Bernice, just before the break, we were talking about how there was this tremendous growth in vaccines that were available and recommended for children. You were talking about what it was like when you were born, and then fast forward another 20, 30 years, and suddenly there are a lot more vaccines.
Right. So now today's 2-year-olds sort of have had probably 24 total doses of some 14 vaccines. And in the 60s, when I was a kid, we had maybe 7 vaccines, and I can't remember how many shots, because the diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus were always combined. So you really have this increase in the number of vaccines, and that has caused concerns among parents. Now, public health authorities, the CDC, they will always say that there are no indications that that children's immune systems are overloaded, or that there are problems with this number of vaccines. But one of the things that one of the conclusions that I came to in the book is that even if there are no scientific conclusions that would lead you to believe that there are concerns about the number of vaccines, there may be a social limit to the number of vaccines that parents are willing for their children to have. And that social limit is important, because it has to do with the way that we perceive our health and perceive the acceptability of medical interventions.
There has been a lot of work done in this country to raise the percentage of children who are vaccinated, a lot of investment made to educate parents and to make sure that kids are getting in to see doctors when they're very small, et cetera. And that has been quite successful. Tell me about our vaccine percentage rates.
So so this year has been a disaster for routine childhood vaccinations because parents are just not taking their children in to see the doctor because of COVID. So if we kind of
set that
go backward
aside
in
for
time
a moment,
to
right.
the year before, right? We can say that vaccination rates for routine childhood diseases have remained very stable and increasing slightly over the last 10 to 20 years. So as you say, it's been very, very successful. We have rates of, so usually what happens is every fall, the MMWR, which is the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, has a set of articles on the national vaccination rates for the previous year. And they're always very, very high. That most of the problems in terms of getting children to be vaccinated on time have to do with logistics, access to insurance or access to federal provision of vaccines. Children are who are not vaccinated or are under vaccinated tend to live in what they call non-metropolitan statistical areas, which is like not cities and not suburbs, so the rural areas, and they tend to be poor children. So those logistical barriers continue to be the primary factors in under vaccination in our country. There is a very vocal minority of people, very small, who are ideologically opposed to vaccination. And that's the arguments against vaccination that are very loud in certain social media contexts and other contexts. But in terms of a proportion of children are not vaccinated at all, like under 2%.
So I think a lot of us remember back in 2014, there was an outbreak of measles that began in Disneyland. And I mean, there was just a furor everywhere about this. Of course, measles is a dangerous disease. And the storyline that we heard surrounding this outbreak of measles was that this is happening because people are refusing to get their children vaccinated. Now, when you tell this story in your book, I was shocked to learn that that measles outbreak was not larger than measles outbreaks in years past. Try to put this in perspective for me.
Right. So the way I tell the story is, the way I like to tell the story is that measles outbreaks, even the measles outbreak in 2019, which was 1,280 people across this country came down with measles, which is a huge number compared to previous years. That these stories should be told as triumphs of public health. So in 2015, so the measles outbreak in 2014 was in December. So really, 2015 is the year that they count for the cases. The number of cases was about 189, which matched 2013, 2 years previously, which was 187 cases nationally. 2014 was unusual because there was a very large outbreak in an under-vaccinated Amish community of almost 400 people. And so that we tend to sort of see 2014 as a kind of anomaly. When you look at 2019, 1,280 cases, how could I say that it's a public health triumph? Well, almost all of the cases were in three different isolated communities. One community of Eastern European immigrants in Washington State and two communities of ultra-Orthodox Jews in New York State. Most of the cases were isolated to those communities, and while it spread, it did not spread across the entire country. In the sense that there were cases in every state, but it wasn't like we had, it's not like COVID, right? Measles is incredibly infectious. It is incredibly infectious. And so the fact that we only had 1,280 cases demonstrates that our vaccination program for measles is actually working. But we don't tend to have mindset, we see any case of measles as a failure rather than saying these outbreaks were actually relatively well contained to these specific communities that were under vaccinated.
So are we blowing this so-called anti-vaxxer movement out of proportion?
So that's a really interesting question, because on the one hand, it's really important to keep track of public sentiment about vaccines and to maintain confidence in vaccine programs. That's the public health view, right? That we have to maintain confidence in public health programs and especially in vaccination programs. And so the fear is that very, very vocal, ideologically anti-vax communities and groups will influence people who are simply hesitant, or people who who have some concerns but are not really ideologically opposed to vaccination. I think that what we should be doing is trying to understand what undermines people's confidence in vaccination, and that's one of the other motivations of my book. Like, what are people really worried about? So there tends to be this attempt to sort of shut down these concerns and say that these concerns are illegitimate. Science has answered these questions. And what I'm trying to do is sort of say, let's look a little bit deeper into the concerns, and maybe we can do more to sort of address the concerns. And in that way, we can be kind of toning down, right? Like, if toning down the concerns for people who need more information and they need their concerns to be addressed, so that we're not inflaming the situation by just saying, you people who don't want to vaccinate, you're stupid or you're wacko, you're gullible, you're just listening to internet celebrities, but like, really, what are your concerns so we can think about how to address them? It's very interesting to me right now that the CDC has developed a project to increase confidence in COVID vaccines, that they realize that this is a real problem, and that the framework is to figure out ways to not just communicate, but also to make decisions in a way that increase confidence in the vaccine program.
Well, and you have some very harsh words for journalists, how they have covered the anti-vaccination movement. And you have some harsh words for public health officials, too, in a lack of communication about vaccines. And you see, in many ways, the anti-vaccine movement as a failure of public health officials?
Well, I would say, so, you know, it's interesting, having published that book in April of 2019. And
yeah,
now
you've seen a lot play out over the last year.
Right. And what I would say now is that I've been following the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which is a federal advisory committee of the CDC. And that's the one that met yesterday to make the recommendation for the allocation of the first COVID vaccines to healthcare workers and residents of long-term care facilities. I have seen that group over the course of the summer and the fall really change in their it's been very subtle, but it's been very significant in making an extremely making ethics and equity a more important part of their framework, their decision making framework, and also making it's very clear to me that both members of the CDC immunization group and members of this federal advisory committee understand that vaccine confidence has been eroded, and that it is their job, insofar as they make decisions transparently, that they provide the data to the public, and that they're really aware of the need to develop more vaccine confidence. And so yes, in my book, I kind of come down hard on this sort of notion that, like, science has answered these questions, therefore we don't have to address concerns of people who think that vaccines are dangerous, to a more nuanced and publicly empathetic view of how people's concerns emerge and how they can be addressed more appropriately by decision makers.
Now, we'll talk about COVID in a few minutes because the way that the pandemic has played out and the way it has been politicized is going to probably influence the vaccination rates and how people feel about it. But I want to put that off for just a couple of minutes. You have interviewed a lot of people who do not want to have their children vaccinated. And as you mentioned earlier, you tried to come at that from a position of openness, a position where you're not judging people or prejudging people. So what do a lot of us have prejudged this whole argument? A lot of us have very strong feelings about that. What do we need to know as people, if you're someone who believes in vaccination, what do we need to know about people who choose not to vaccinate their children?
So the themes that emerged in our interviews were really, really interesting. One is that many people feel that being ill and recovering from illness is a sign of health, and that preventing illness is actually not good for people. Another theme that emerged, and related to that, are people who really feel that childhood illness is very important for children's development overall, physical, emotional, psychological development, that childhood illness is kind of like a springboard for future development. Another theme that emerged was this idea that the vaccines keep us, and other medications actually, keep us from really attending to the body when it is ill. So you take medicine to address your symptoms, and you go to work while you're still sick. People send their kids to school while sick if they're on medications that mask their symptoms. There was the communities that we interviewed where we were interviewing people who were hesitant or resistant to vaccination, there was this idea that we have to support the body, and we support the body through adequate nutrition. We don't eat junk food. We are very careful about our activity. So there was a lot of attention to the body and a lot of attention to this idea that illness is a part of the human experience and that we mess around with that to our peril. There were also some other more philosophical themes about what are we doing to our children's bodies that we don't really know how that will affect them in the future and how it will affect the world that we live in, messing around with microbes, with bacteria, and with viruses and changing the way that these circulate in our world. May have an effect on the Earth itself in a way, and our future as humans. That was a theme that emerged as well. The overall, what I would say is that, the one other one that I would say is that there are a lot of people who say that people who won't vaccinate their children or won't vaccinate themselves are irresponsible. And what our interviews showed that people in communities where they were not vaccinating had a different sense of what it meant to be a responsible community member. And this had to do, again, with if you're sick, you stay home. You don't infect others. You don't take medication to mask your symptoms if you're still infectious and go out into the world. And so what we found was that there was strong sense of social responsibility, but it was articulated differently. And so those are some of the things that I would want people to know, that there is not sort of this thoughtless, selfish, particularly gullible sort of, anti-vax parent who's not considering their community, not considering the health of their children. They're doing so, but they're thinking about it differently than people who vaccinate.
So demonizing people who make that decision, obviously, is not productive. Mm-hmm. And we have about 30 seconds before a break. And many times in the book, you mention yelling about this, telling people that they're being irresponsible, trying to show them scientific facts. This is not going to persuade people. So in 30 seconds before we go to the break, is there something that public health officials can embrace that might be persuasive?
Well, what I would say is that that epidemiologists who work in the field know that they have to get to know people and gain their trust in order to be effective in the work that they do. And that's what we need to be thinking about, is why people mistrust public health officials with regard to vaccination.
All right. Well, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. And we're going to focus, as we go on the COVID-19 vaccines, people who might be resistant to getting those vaccines, and also people who have already embraced those vaccinations. With me, Bernice Hausman is here. She is the author of Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. Coming up in just a moment, we'll also welcome anthropologist Emily Wenzel into the conversation. She's been interviewing people here in Iowa who volunteered to be part of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine study at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about vaccinations, and Bernice Hausman is here with me. She's the author of Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. And we're going to turn the conversation now to COVID-19 vaccinations. Of course, there is a lot of excitement about these vaccinations. They're also really under the microscope. They inspire a lot of hope, but also raise a lot of questions. And although I don't think, Bernice, you're probably clairvoyant, we are going to try to look ahead. And we're also going to bring anthropologist Emily Wenzel into the conversation. She's been interviewing people here in Iowa who volunteered to be part of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine study at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. She is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Director of the CLAS International Studies Program at the University of Iowa. Hello, Emily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And Bernice, I'd like to start this for you with you. When we look at the COVID-19 vaccine and think about getting people to be willing to be vaccinated and sending that public health message out to people all over the country, what are your concerns? What do you think could go wrong here?
Yeah, my biggest concern is the freezers. So, I say that sort of tongue in cheek, but I think I've been thinking about how much we worry about people who might be hesitant about the vaccine, and the hesitance is only one piece of a really big logistical puzzle, right? Because we have a complex epidemiological context. We have a complex ethical situation. We have the logistics of these vaccines that both the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines have very stringent refrigeration requirements. And so people's hesitancy is really only one factor in this really complex situation. Added on to that is that we really have, we're going to have a phased rollout because in December there are only going to be about 40 million doses available. So that would be at the maximum 20 million people who could get the vaccine. And we have healthcare workers and people in long-term care facilities prioritized, at least by the CDC advisory committee. We expect that prioritization will probably continue down through the states, which will actually be dispersing the vaccines. So ordinary, and then you have essential workers after that, probably, and after that, elderly people and people with who are susceptible because of health conditions that they have. So we're not looking at the general population of adults having access to vaccines until later in the spring, at which point they're going to have seen more safety and efficacy data as the vaccines are rolled out. So I would put concerns about hesitation with the vaccine not at the forefront, although encouraging vaccine confidence is obviously part of the whole package.
It's interesting. I mean, we've seen a lot of denial involved in this pandemic, and we've seen some of the same people who want to say that the virus is not a big deal and it's no worse than the flu, which of course we know is not true. We see this some of the same people also saying, and we'll have a vaccine, which feels like a pretty big contradiction, where we are ignoring science on one hand and embracing it on the other. Do you think that that's going to create some problems as we roll this out?
So I think that, I guess I tend to think that some of the issues that, so I study language use, and when the idea that people are, I think this sort of, I'm having trouble kind of like conceptualizing what I really want to say, but the fact that some people are saying that the virus isn't that big of a deal does not necessarily correlate with the their acceptance of a vaccine or even what they think about the illness. It's a discourse that's available for people who have concerns about the way that the coronavirus pandemic has been managed in this country. So one can say things like, it's not that big of a deal. I'm not really concerned about that as an illness. And we don't really know the complexity of people's real responses to the illness until we talk to them more and find out why they think that and what that why they're using that language to talk about the way that they're responding. I think another big issue is the people's concerns throughout the country about state authority to force people to do things with their bodies like wear masks or stay home. And there are significant concerns in vaccine-resistant communities that there will be a mandate for COVID vaccines because, and they fear that because the states have taken, you know, very authoritarian positions, that will be the same with the vaccine. And so I think we're going to see that concern emerging as the vaccines are rolled out.
All right. And we've been talking about trying to get some insight into people who might refuse vaccines. Let's get a little insight into people who are early adopters and embracing vaccines. Emily Wenzel, tell me a little bit about your involvement with this Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine study.
Sure. So as Professor Hausman was, I think, nicely saying, people are complicated, and what they say and even believe that they will do is often very different from what they actually do or tell others they will do or have done. So in anthropology, we really talk to people about their concrete experiences and observe those experiences to understand, not on a hypothetical level, but on a level of lived experience. So I and a research partner have been interviewing people who were in this COVID vaccine trial. So they either got the active Pfizer vaccine or placebo. And we've been talking to them to see why they decided to volunteer, what their experience was, but also what people have said to them, both the positive and the negative, as a way to try to predict what people's objections might be or the reasons people might seek out the vaccine.
So in talking to people, are there some generalizations that you can make for us? Who are the people who said, hey, I want to be among the first to get this vaccine? Possibly. I have a 50% shot.
Yeah. So I think an important finding is that they are all over the map, right? In terms of things like PPE use, there seem to be political divides, and that was not true for who wanted to be in this vaccine study. People from all different political persuasions, ages, occupations. Demographics did not seem to matter very much in terms of who wanted to be in the study. And it was really a feeling of duty, the desire to return to normalcy and help others return to normalcy, the desire to protect others. I should also note that, just like Professor Hausman was saying, since hesitance is not a fixed trait, while many of the people in the study sort of characterize themselves as supporters of science or people who believe in science and so wanted to show that this vaccine would be safe by participating, some others were not always so convinced of that, but then life led them to participate. For example, one participant, when he heard about the trial, said, oh, there's no way I'm going to be their guinea pig. That was his language. But then he started dating a partner who had a mother who was immunocompromised. And when he got an email about the study, boom, he signed up instantly. So life matters, too.
Interesting. And with this study, Pfizer tried very hard to recruit a very diverse group of people, right? Can you give me a little bit of information about that?
Yeah. Well, as Dr. Hausman was, I think, referencing, in America, we do have a lot of concerns about equity when it comes to vaccine and healthcare. And those concerns are rooted in very real and enduring inequities, particularly for like Black Americans, things like the Tuskegee trial, right? There have been a lot of instances of people being treated very, very badly by the healthcare system. Yeah. So trust is an issue. So you want to make sure that in any given medical trial, you have people from a diverse range of backgrounds and experiences and life experiences. So I think Pfizer tried quite hard, and the researchers here tried quite hard to recruit people from a number of backgrounds. And that was also a reason many people participated. They wanted to represent either their racial or ethnic group, their age group, people in their same occupation. Many people sort of felt called to participate in order to represent others, and then also to be a model for others in whatever their group was, that this was a safe thing to do.
Now, you mentioned how people in their lives have responded to their participation in this trial. Of course, they didn't actually have to tell people in their lives necessarily that they were participating in this trial. But what did you learn about that? How others were reacting? We know a lot about complicated responses to COVID-19 and here in the state of Iowa.
Yes. So we did ask about, you know, are you telling others? Who are you telling? Why? And for the most part, people were pretty talkative about this experience. There were a few who just thought, oh, my medical history is private, and a few who chose not to tell certain relatives they thought would see this as problematic or had particular political views about COVID or the vaccine. But many people did what one participant called using it as a PSA, like a public service announcement. They really saw participating helping in two key ways, both by like getting an actual effective vaccine to market, but also by modeling and demonstrating that this was a safe thing to do. So they were sort of living out being what they would call like a test case for this vaccine to show others, hey, this is okay.
You know, Bernice, one of the things that we're hearing about the vaccine is that there are side effects to getting the vaccine, that that's part of how it works, how it develops immunity in our bodies. As we watch people start to get this vaccine and see things play out, what are you looking for in how people come to understand that, yes, you'll get the vaccine and maybe it's more than just a sore arm?
Yeah, it's a really interesting development, this perhaps small, perhaps larger group of people who are going to have severe but transient, what they call reactogenicity. And how that gets narrativized and the stories that people will tell about that will be very important in the subsequent sort of like uptake of the vaccine, or at least people's perceptions of it. It made me think about the HPV vaccine, because that vaccine was notoriously, it hurt, you know. So you had these teenage girls. My daughter was 12 years old in 2006 when the HPV vaccine was originally approved and licensed and recommended for use in preteen girls. And so that was the talk of the middle school-aged girls, right, mm-hmm. was the how much the HPV vaccine shots hurt. And so I think that that's one of the things that we'll be looking for. What are the stories that are told about the adverse reactions? And then also, how do people then accommodate that? There's actually a really significant logistical question about vaccinating healthcare workers, because if you do get, let's say, fever for 12 hours after you get your second dose of the COVID vaccine, you're going to have to stagger vaccinations in healthcare facilities so not everybody is sick at the same time.
Right. Not everybody feels awful on the same day.
That's right. That's right. So I think it'll be really interesting. And then, of course, there's the bigger question of post-licensure safety monitoring. And there was a presentation yesterday at the ACIP meeting, on all of the enhanced monitoring for safety that they are going to implement with the COVID vaccines, including a smartphone option called VSafe. So they're really hoping to capture in a very, very rigorous way any kind of adverse reactions. They're encouraging people to use the reporting system, VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which is a federal system. But there are other elements to the monitoring that they're going to be using.
Since you mentioned the HPV vaccine, we had Marilee call us from Cedar Rapids and unfortunately just don't have time to take the call. But she did just want to say that for the past 2 years, she's been battling cervical cancer, and the entire time she's been going through chemotherapy, she just keeps thinking about this HPV vaccine that wasn't available for her when she was a child, but now there is that option. And it's so frustrating to her that some people might not allow their child to get this vaccine when it could prevent the kind of pain that, that she's going through. And that's, of course, an incredibly important part of the message with the COVID-19 vaccine, too, is actually helping people understand that this is serious and possibly deadly. And you're not just protecting yourself, but you're protecting others in your community. Emily, I'm sorry I interrupted. What did you want to add to that?
No, I was going to say that I do have examples of the kinds of narratives people are telling about side effects in the study, and that I think can be helpful for when we start to market these vaccines. For the most part, study participants who experienced pretty significant flu-like symptoms for a day or so were really excited because they had
because
a 50%
they got
chance
the
of
real
getting the
vaccine.
Right. Yes, they thought they got the real vaccine, but also they thought, oh, you know, I'm having a really good immune response to this, so the chance of it working for me is higher. And in terms of American medical cultures in general, we're a country that is actually really tolerant of side effects compared to places that tend to focus on, say, traditional Chinese medicine, keeping the body in balance. We're like, bring it on, all those drug ads with a list of side effects do not deter people. So I think if we can frame the transient side effects as showing that it's working, that will be really successful.
Interesting. And so given the experience that you've had, we've only got 2 minutes left here, Emily, in talking with the people who've received the vaccine and the placebo who've been part of this study so far, I just want to gauge your optimism. How are you feeling about the vaccine and the future?
Oh, deeply optimistic. I also think, you know, vaccine hesitance, since it's not a fixed trait, the fact that it's a staggered rollout, a lot of the objections people had heard, the study participants heard, were that, oh, it's too soon, or oh, I'm scared of the side effects for you because it's so new, or oh, the vaccine development was so quick. That was a big concern a lot of people in the lives of these research participants had. So I think the fact that healthcare workers and other groups will get it first and then can model, hey, we're okay, and now we're safer, I think that will really serve a lot to show that, oh, this is a safe vaccine, this is preferable to getting COVID. And I think that in itself will kind of do that marketing.
Emily, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Sure.
Anthropologist Emily Wenzel of the University of Iowa. She's been interviewing people who were part of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine study at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. And I'm going to ask you the same question, Bernice, with about a minute left. As you look to the future, knowing all that you know about vaccines and how closely you've been watching what's going on, how optimistic do you feel?
Well, I guess I would say I feel glad that there's something coming to market so we can finally start to see some real live, actual population level vaccination efforts. And like Professor Wenzel, I think that the phased rollout is going to be very positive for confidence if rare adverse events that are really serious don't start to emerge once we move from vaccinating tens of thousands of people to millions of people. So that's always the big concern in vaccination rollout, is that something will start to emerge at the population level that was not apparent at the clinical trial level.
We will just have to wait and see. Bernice Hausman, thank you so much, author of Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.